This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and today is Native American Heritage Day, and we are celebrating with this nation's first Indigenous Poet Laureate, Joy Harjo. Joy Harjo is the author of 9 books of poetry, including the highly acclaimed An American Sunrise. She's also written several plays, children's books, and 2 memoirs. She's a member of the Muscogee Creek Nation. She is a musician and a performer. She has held 2 National Endowment for the Arts fellowships and a Guggenheim Fellowship. She will be coming to North Dakota in February, and she recently spoke at an online event from the Fond du Lac Tribal and Community College and the American Indian Community Housing Organization.
Meadow, thank you. I'm here, Joy Harjo Chio Chifkiros. I am a member of the Muscogee Creek Nation. I'm Ojibwe Ceremonial Ground, and I'm speaking to you from the Muscogee Creek Nation Reservation here in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And I've been up to your part of the world many times, and well, not many, but some. And I've met many of the poets and people from up that way, in that beautiful way. And I was thinking about what I was going to read tonight, and it does. You can finally feel the fall coming. There's a full moon getting full, and I love this. So we were talking beforehand about the moon on the water, and I could smell it, and I could hear the quiet, the water, and feel it. So I think tonight I will read poetry, but I'm going to read some from the memoir, Poet Warrior, which weaves poetry, but because of the changing of the seasons, I just thought it would be good to read some little bit of stories too. But I'm going to start with this one. It's called For Calling the Spirit Back from Wandering the Earth in Its Human Feet. And I guess, too, it's something we do in the fall and as we head towards winter, especially in climates where we have cold weather or colder weather, is we do start calling, you know, we've been out, there's been harvest and all that, and we start calling ourselves back in to be in another kind of way. But we also do that in ages. In a way, that's what's been going on in the pandemic, because we had to call ourselves back for a while to remember who we are, what's going on, and to recognize the crisis that we're in together, and we've been in together at so many levels, and to find ways that we can gather together and figure it out in ways that include the good of everyone. For calling the spirit back from wandering the earth in its human feet. Put down that bag of potato chips, that white bread, that bottle of pop. Turn off that cell phone, computer, and remote control. Open the door, then close it behind you. Take a breath offered by friendly winds. They travel the earth, gathering essences of plants to clean. Give it back with gratitude. If you sing, it will give your spirit lift to fly to the stars, ears, and back. Acknowledge the earth who has cared for you since you were a dream, planting itself precisely within your parents' desire. Let your moccasin feet take you to the encampment of the guardians who have known you before time, who will be there after time. They sit before the fire that has been there without time. Let the earth stabilize your post-colonial insecure jitters. Be respectful of the small insects, birds, and animal people who accompany you. Ask their forgiveness for the harm we humans have brought down upon them. Don't worry. The heart knows the way, though there may be high-rises, interstates, checkpoints, armed soldiers, massacres, wars, and those who will despise you because they despise themselves. The journey might take you a few hours, a day, a year, a few years, 100, 1,000, or even more. Watch your mind. Without training, it might run away and Leave your heart for the immense human feast set by thieves of time. Do not hold regrets. When you find your way to the circle, to the fire kept burning by the keepers of your soul, you will be welcomed. You must clean yourself with cedar sage or other healing plant. Cut the ties you have to failure and shame. Let go the pain you are holding in your mind, your shoulders, your heart, all the way to your feet. Let go the pain of your ancestors to make way for those who are heading in our direction. Ask for forgiveness. Call upon the help of those who love you. Call your spirit back. It may be caught in corners and creases of shame, judgment, and human abuse. You must call in a way that your spirit will want to return. Speak to it as you would a beloved child. Welcome your spirit back from its wandering. It may return in pieces and tatters. Gather them together. They will be happy to be found after being lost for so long. Your spirit will need to sleep a while after it is bathed and given clean clothes. Now you can have a party. Invite everyone you know who loves and supports you. Keep room for those who have no place else to go. Make a giveaway and remember, keep the speeches short. Then you must do this. Help the next person find their way through the dark. Okay. I was going to read. Maybe because I was just out in LA. I had to go help record something. And I wound up living there for a little while, I think because I said, I will never live in LA. And never is one of those dangerous magic words. Anytime you say never, you're going to find yourself doing that. It also goes along with the law of judgment. When you judge somebody else pointedly, there you are doing the same thing. So anyway, we were taping about a few blocks from the first place I lived there, which was an apartment right off, a studio apartment, a tiny little place right off Wilcox in Hollywood Boulevard. I had never lived in a place like that. I didn't live in that little place long, and then moved to Laurel Canyon and then stayed with my cousin and then et cetera, et cetera. The path to the Milky Way leads through Los Angeles. There are strangers above me, below me, and all around me, and we are all strange in this place of recent invention. The city name for angels appears naked and stripped of anything resembling the shaking of turtle shells, the songs of human voices on a summer night outside Okmulgee. Yet it's perpetually summer here and beautiful. The shimmer of gods is easier to perceive at sunrise or dusk. When those who remember us here in the illusion of the marketplace turn toward the changing of the sun and say our names, we matter to somebody. We must matter to the strange god who imagines us as we revolve together in the dark sky on the path to the Milky Way. We can't easily see that starry road from the perspective of the crossing of boulevards. Can't hear it in the whine of civilization or taste the minerals of planets and hamburgers. But we can buy a map of the stars' homes, dial a tone for dangerous love, choose from several brands of water or a hiss of oxygen for gentle rejuvenation. Everyone knows you can't buy love, but you can still sell your soul for less than a song to a stranger who will sell it to someone else for a profit until you're owned by a company of strangers in this city of strange and getting stranger. I'd rather understand how to sing from a crow who is never good at singing or much of anything, but finding gold in the trash of humans. So what are we doing here? I asked the crow parading on the ledge of falling, that hangs over this precarious city. Crow just laughs and says, wait, and see. And I am waiting and not seeing anything, not just yet. But like Crow, I collect the shine of anything beautiful I can find.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and today we are sharing an excerpt from a recent presentation with U.S. Poet Laureate Joy Harjo. After this break, she talks about being a creative during a pandemic.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
I'm Martha Barnett.
And I'm Grant Barrett.
And we are co-hosts of Away with Words. My background is in classical languages, and I never expected that I would be doing something every single day with ancient Greek, which is why I went into journalism. But this job combines both of those things in a really wonderful way.
I used to be a journalist as well, and an editor and an IT guy, but I've always had an interest in language, and I had an opportunity to join the American Dialect Society and eventually become an editor of dictionaries for Oxford University Press, where I specialized in new words and slang. So you bring Martha's classical stuff with my new novel stuff, and I think we kind of cover the gamut of what has happened and has happened in English.
I don't really think it's a challenge to make this topic interesting to people because we all speak language, we all share stories, and people are a lot more curious about this than they realize. They might think initially, oh, this show isn't going to be interesting.
Yeah, they think it's two stuffy grammarians with corduroy jackets and patches on their elbows, but we're not cobwebby old school marks. Join us every Saturday morning at 9 a.m. Central, 8 a.m. Mountain for Away with Words on member-supported Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and today is Native American Heritage Day, and we are sharing an excerpt from a recent online event featuring U.S. Poet Laureate Joy Harjo, a member of the Muscogee Creek Nation, who will be coming to North Dakota in February as part of the Big Read event. Here's the rest of that presentation.
So during the pandemic, I've been working. I got a new album out called I Pray for My Enemies, an album of music, and got out, worked on the anthology, The Poet Laureate Project, and this memoir. My last memoir, Crazy Brave, was 14 years late to the publisher. That's another story. And this one I got in ahead of time. And I'm just going to talk and read some selections from here. What opened it for me was the memory of going with my Aunt Lois all over the Creek Nation and visiting with relatives, the elders. And she was a little older than me, and I used to drive her around. I would drive her around. That was one of my favorite things to do, is to hear those stories. And we would go visit one cousin of hers we liked to visit was George Kozer. And he had a lot of stories, and he'd been the rodeo. He knew rope tricks, and he was quite a talker, and he knew a lot of good stories. And the book ends with my cousin George Kozer Jr. and I visiting, talking the same, you know, it's like it doesn't end. We're still, you know, it's part of a spiral. I was going to say a circle, but it's not a closed circle. It's more like a spiral. I return to the stories that I was told. The stories I can't seem to remember or keep straight to the telling. Like the ones I heard when I used to drive my Aunt Lois around the Creek Nation to visit our relatives, all her age and older, which is near the age I am now. This was when I was in my 20s and 30s, and when she lived in her apartment on West 8th Street in Okmulgee, before she was disabled with a stroke and taken to a nursing home to live out the last few years of her life. Every day I miss her cultural knowledge of our people, her insight and humor. I miss the historical documents and family artifacts that crowded her small apartment that told of our family's part in the forced march from the South to Indian Territory to what became known as Oklahoma. These stacks contained written accounts of family stories of bravery and justice, but left out the story she told me of favorite black dogs, horse magic, bending time, how to avoid the places where known conjurers lived, and of the Spanish man accompanying the people on the trail who wore a diamond pin that glittered as he sat tall on his horse. One of her paintings accompanies me through my life since her passing. It is a painting of a Taos man pulling a piece of pottery out of fire. She used to make many trips to the Southwest and was friends with many of the Pueblo people, including Maria Martinez, the San Ildefonso potter. I am now friends with her grandchildren. When I was with her, I knew I belonged. And in this circle of belonging, I had a place in the stories. Everyone needs this kind of place, this feeling of kinship. Without it, we are lost children wandering the earth our whole lives without a sense of belonging. Even a country can be like a lost child because it may have no roots in the earth on which it has established itself. I miss being in my aunt's tall physical presence, her graceful and private bearing. Her spiritual presence remains, urging me forward to understanding and love. To knowledge given by her example. She was an artist, a painter, a lover of the arts, of native arts and cultures. She worked at the Creek Council House and taught art classes in Okmulgee. I am writing in an apartment in downtown Tulsa. I was born before cell phones and computers, before the proliferation of devices installed with memory, which prompt the user to forget. I do not want to forget, though sometimes memory appears to be an enemy bringing only pain. There are so many memories. One returned my mother to me. That memory opened up in a dream. There she was sitting on the roof of a house in red shorts, not long after she gave birth to me. I wish that I had written down everything my aunt and all the elders told me so I could have their wisdom, their struggles, their hard-won stories right here for referral to provoke, even cultivate new stories. Growing memories and the ability to access memory is a skill that allows access to eternity. It is within all of us. I do not have the best memory. I often tell the circle of old ones whom, when I speak with them, and I do speak with those whom I love who have moved on from this earthly realm, especially when writing poetry or any kind of story or music. They remind me, here's your opportunity to practice memory. I am not the best speaker or listener, I tell them. Take your opportunity with grace, they tell me. You are here to learn. Learn how to listen, how to walk into each challenging story without fear, fearless. I have asked my aunt, uncles, cousins, and others, all those with whom I sat, listened, and shared throughout this life to be with me as I write. It is a very different world within which you make stories, share, and participate, they tell me. Too many words, I heard one grandfather remark. What is it with you and all these English words? These times were predicted, a time in which the birds would be confused about which direction to fly to migrate, a time in which the sun would darken with pollution, a time in which there would be confusion and famine. In these kinds of times, we are in great danger of forgetting our original teachings, the nature of the kind of world we share, and what it requires of us. In this world of forgetfulness, they told me, you will forget how to nourish the connection between humans, plants, animals, and the elements, a connection needed to make food for your mind, heart, body, and spirit. You were born of a generation that promised to help remember. Each generation makes a person. You came in together to make change. As I near the last doorway of this present life, I am trying to understand the restless path on which I have traveled. My failures have been my most exacting teachers. They are all linked by one central characteristic, and that is the failure to properly regard the voice of inner truth. That voice speaks softly. It is not judgmental, full of pride, or otherwise loud. It does not deride, shame, or otherwise attempt to derail you. When I fail to trust what my deepest knowing tells me, I suffer. The voice of inner truth or the knowing has access to the wisdom of eternal knowledge. The perspective of that voice is timeless. I would never have become a poet if I hadn't listened to that small inner voice that told me that poetry was the path, even when I had different plans. All of the other voices of educators, friends, voices of love and concern told me that poetry was an impossible vocation. It is an impossible vocation. They reminded me I had two small children to raise alone, that I could change my major to education. Then I could teach poetry if I wanted to be invested in poetry. Instead, I listened to that humble voice that did not need to puff itself up or have approval to be chosen. I have made choices that have made no sense to anyone else, but they were the right choices for me. I didn't always understand them either. Even the choice to be a poet is still often a mystery, just as the need to create and make music. When I listen, I am always led in the right direction. That doesn't mean the resultant path is easy. It might be the more difficult path. You may have to clear boulders, walk through fire after fire, or try to find footing in precarious flooding. You will play the wrong notes and write words that mean nothing to anyone else but you. And you may appear to have followed the wrong path, even though it was the right path, as you fail over and over again. So that's part of that. I'm just reading sections out of here, just to be helpful. This part here, this is... Somebody asked me earlier in the earlier session about writing what was difficult. So I might read some of that here. This whole book, I go over some of the territory of Crazy Brave, but from a different kind of place, and then go farther than that into other places. But I'm going to read this difficult part. Because while writing this, I don't always know what's going to happen when I write, and I just follow and listen and then help construct something. So in this book, there is it's kind of became a poetic voice called Girl Warrior. She's a character representative probably of a younger me, and she's going through difficulty. And I didn't have a coming of age ceremony when I was a young woman. We all need those doorways. And so when I came to this part in the book that was difficult and painful to write, some part of me said, went back into time to bring people together to make that ceremony for this young woman who was, yes, represents me, but represents in a way all of our young women coming of age who need a community, the circle of, especially the mothers, grandmothers around them, but the whole family, the circle of family around them. So, yeah, it was interesting when this happened, and I thought, I didn't know I could do this in a book. So, but I think by nature, poetry, song, we heard a song, we heard prayer and welcoming. By nature, it's like ritual. It's like patterning, and we need that. When we come of age, we need that doorway. I think of a poem in a way as being by its nature, you know, ritualistic or ceremony. There's the title that calls you in, and then each line in a way brings a gift or brings something that is needed for that particular coming together of a poem. So this girl warrior, that's her name. And then she becomes, after the ceremony, they give her the name. Girl Warrior lied and said she was going out with her friend to hang out at her house. She wasn't a friend, rather a girl she barely knew, and had a bad feeling when she asked her to double date. Girl Warrior was not allowed to date, nor was she usually allowed to go anywhere with friends or without. But she begged her mother, and her stepfather was working late, i.e. he was seeing a woman on the other side of town. Girl Warrior got in the car and knew her fate was in the hands of reckless strangers. She had a dime taped inside her shoe for a phone call, but who would she call if there was trouble? No one. They drove to another town. Her date was 10 years older. He bought them beer. What the hell? It was the first time she had anything resembling a date. She wanted to be normal. Every drink made her feel more and more normal. Girl Warrior's new girlfriend left with her boyfriend without telling her. She saw the red of their taillights disappear into darkness that grew larger and larger until Girl Warrior had no way to get home. She just wanted to be normal, drink Cokes, flip her hair back and laugh with someone who might offer his hand, his jacket, or other small kindness between new friends. There was more beer, but she wanted a ride before her stepfather made it back to the house she had to pay the darkness. Either way. This is how I came of age, by a tightrope slung between my desires and the desires of others. I was hungry for ritual. Ritual creates belonging. We are all in a ritual marked by sunrise, daylight, sunset, night, and moon phases. We also move within the ritual of the changing of seasons, either fall, winter, spring, and summer, or dry and rainy seasons. Our cultural practices are arranged according to these earth rituals. We all need rituals of becoming in which we are given instructions that define our relationship with becoming, with our relatives, those sharing this whole world around us. This is how it was meant to be for those coming up at all stages of our becoming in this life. In these times, however, of degradation of our physical, mental, and spiritual sources of nourishment, we are losing ourselves and our children. Until we understand and act as if we are the earth, then each of us will experience the pain of separation from sacred knowledge from ourselves. I walk back in time to help make a coming of age ceremony for Girl Warrior. I construct a doorway where sunrise is a line above a dark blue horizon. Her grandmothers and great grandmothers gather around and speak. The ancestors appear here to help because she is one of us. She is us. She is worthy of love, of tenderness, of all that she needs to create a future. The world lives within the cradle of her hips. She is every girl, this girl. They tell her that every 7 years marks a renewal, a shift, and a test. Seven is considered a sacred number. Within it are the four directions above, below, and within. It makes a complete cycle. They tell her that the second cycle of seven in our lives marks a crisis in becoming. We mature into adulthood. A boy becomes a man, a girl becomes a woman. Becoming includes a countless range of gender expression. Be exactly who you are, they tell her, in your becoming. They remind her that she is holding tremendous power, and power has two sides. It can harm or heal. To hold such power can be difficult. That's why we need guidance and ritual and ceremony, especially at this age, but at any age, for power without grounding and sharing can destroy. In our Muscogee tribal traditions, adolescence is a time of teaching and celebration, the old ones say. As you enter this doorway of womanhood, they tell her, you must keep the fire going of Agasama, Samga, or spiritual belief. You must seek and acquire a spiritual understanding of life. Your relationship with your creator is central. Tend it with quiet and communion. Turn your eyes and ears inward and listen. Begin every morning tending this fire. Imadalamga is community. Your body is a community of organs, all living with consciousness. They work together to house you in this story. Community is those with whom you live, from home to school to your tribal nation, city, or state. You must remember to place community interest and benefits above individual, personal, and personal gain. Always be kind and humble. Iyaskara is humility. None of us is above the other. Aflaquechka means respect. Respect this gift of life, and in doing so, we respect ourselves and others. Vajra is integrity. Be honest. Tell the truth. Keep an ethical stance. Emin honathleta dayat translates as trust. Take responsibility for every act, thought, or dream. Hoposlinga is the continual gaining of wisdom. Listen, study hard, beloved granddaughter. In homodetta is leadership. We are all put here to be leaders within ourselves, our families, and our communities. Be a leader. Do not forget that we are here and will always be here for you. You can call on us anytime. We love you. They wrap girl warrior in a new blanket and walk her out to the doorway of her beginning, which is also a new beginning for us, her family. A beautiful sunrise brightens the sky. She's given her new name. She is given gifts. One gives her plants that will help her to help herself and others. And then so on and so on. And it says, you are becoming in a time in which you will see the world turn upside down before it is renewed, they tell her. And so through that, she becomes poet warrior. Children coming of age need to be taught by the elders who pass on what has strengthened and inspired them in life. When this time of becoming is honored by their families, their community, the young ones emerge into adulthood with the lit charge to develop spiritually, mentally, and physically, and are on an intimate part of carrying the community into the future. Here's a little piece. This is like a little poem inside the narrative. Poet warrior reached for a gun. She was given a paintbrush, a saxophone, a pen. These will be your instruments of power, the old one said, though the gun gleamed and pranced as a tool of takeover by governments, even as it danced through the imagination of revolutionaries as the perfect tool for social change. Do not be fooled, they told her. Violence might be louder, tougher, and it is often good-looking. The power of insight and compassion is fiercely humble and helpful. Be ready for what your age demands. You will be tested. There will be jealousy, envy. But the most difficult enemies will be from your closest circle, even your family. You must act in a manner that will cause no harm to anyone, seven generations back or forward. See, when I write, I feel like I'm listening. I feel like I'm being taught as I write. I'm going to end with this poem. It's a new one. It's called Without. And I want to thank you for inviting me here to be up in your community. Even if it's virtual, we're all still here. And I can feel that moon on the lake. Without. The world will keep trudging through time without us. When we lift from the story contest to fly home. We will be as falling stars to those watching from the edge of grief and heartbreak. Maybe then we will see the design of the two-minded creature and know why half the world fights righteously for greedy masters and the other half is nailing it all back together through the smoke of cooking fires, lovers' trysts, and endless human industry. Maybe then, beloved rascal, we will find each other again in the timeless weave of breathing. We will sit under the trees in the shadow of earth's sorrows, watch hyenas drink rain, and laugh.
That was U.S. Poet Laureate Joy Harjo, who is currently serving her third term as Poet Laureate, our nation's first Indigenous Poet Laureate. She is a member of the Muscogee Creek Nation. She has written 9 books of poetry, including An American Sunrise. She has also written 2 memoirs and has won many awards, including the Ruth Lilly Prize for Lifetime Achievement from the Poetry Foundation. That event comes to us from the Fond du Lac Tribal and Community College and the American Indian Community Housing Organization. Additional funding came from the Oldenburg Arts and Cultural Community, the Minnesota Center for the Book, the Library of Congress, the Arrowhead Regional Arts Council, and the Northland Foundation.
Join longtime host and Washburn, North Dakota native Lloyd Anderson every Friday at 8 Central, 7 Mountain for Friday Night Swing.
I've been a collector of records, especially jazz, since I was about 12. And in 1981, I convinced the radio management at Prairie Public to let me have a shot at doing a radio show, and I've been doing one ever since. Well, I play lots of the big names, Ellington, Coltrane, Ella Fitzgerald, Sinatra, but I also try to feature many of the players who are lesser known, say Paul Kinache, Andy Kirk.
Get yourself in a weekend state of mind with Lloyd Anderson and Friday Night Swing, Fridays at 8 p.m. Central, 7 Mountain on Prairie Public.
I think life is a continuum, and hopefully so is the music on Friday Night Swing.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and many people on the day after Thanksgiving are celebrating an unofficial holiday that is Black Friday. Of course, a big shopping day in the United States. Today, we're going to share an essay from writer Sean Ann Tangney about how shopping can be so much more than buying things.
Good friends, good finds, and cocktails after. I did something I really enjoy recently. I went shopping with a friend. We spent a Saturday afternoon scouring vintage and used clothing stores, and we had a marvelous time trying on the silly, a see-through pantsuit with a halter top and a waist-deep plunging neckline, the spectacular, a shaggy blue-cream camel tri-toned fake fur coat, and the mundane, hiking pants. We giggled and cringed, oohed and awed, called to one another over the dressing room stalls, "Oh, wait till you see this." It was a delightful afternoon, and we capped it off with drinks and an early dinner, and then we both went home, me with that fur and she with the hiking pants, among many, many other things, very satisfied with ourselves. Going shopping with a friend might not seem like that big a deal, except that we are still dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic. Like millions and millions of other people have throughout this now almost 2-year battle with COVID, I have turned to online shopping for lots and lots of things. At first, in March and April of 2020, it seemed a safe and easy way to procure necessary things like shampoo and laundry detergent, toothpaste and toilet bowl cleaner. Stores in my area weren't totally shut down, but it seemed wise to stay away as much as I could, and hey, all this stuff really was cheaper online, so why not just stock up and feel safe at the same time? As the pandemic endured, and as I spent more time browsing one site or another for those necessary things, I started to toss more and more not-so-necessary things into my shopping cart. "Ooh, those are cute socks," I'd say. And, "Well, I'm staying home all the time. I could use a couple new pairs of leggings." As the months went by and things inched toward normal, the very definition of necessary things changed. Of course I needed sequined face masks. Who doesn't? And when things finally approached fully normal in my area, I succumbed to a full-on frenzy of online shopping. It was time to go out in the world again, and I needed new everything. Suddenly, everything was a necessary thing. New jeans, blouses, dresses, shoes, skirts, shorts. A whole new wardrobe for a whole new world. I didn't really need all those things. I mean, staying home and having a pretty limited social life for months and months meant the wardrobe I already owned hadn't gotten much use at all. I started buying all those clothes, partly, I think, because hitting the restart button on life out in the world seemed to call for them. But that may be a massive rationalization. The truth may be that I am, and have always been, a bit of a clothes horse, and I really, really like going shopping. I blame my mother and my grandmother for both of these things. My grandmother was in no way frumpy or dowdy, but her wardrobe was neither large nor expensive, and was not fanciful in any way. It was solid. Her clothes were well made, good fitting, good quality. It was a straightforward and serviceable wardrobe. But she had a keen eye for fashion. She was a very talented seamstress, and she knew clothing literally from the inside out. She knew what looked good and why. She knew the difference between trend and style. She knew how to bring fabric and the human body into harmony better than almost anyone I've ever known. And more than for herself, she wanted a good and stylish and beautiful clothes for her daughter, and when I came along, for her granddaughter. My mother was built for clothes. She was 5'6" and weighed 118 pounds. She was slim and long-legged, small-breasted and narrow-hipped, and clothes fit her like a dream. Her wardrobe was always very au courant. In the 1960s, she wore miniskirts, and tighter and shorter than anybody else, and tall boots, and she had a chocolate brown suede floppy hat that made her look like she'd just walked out of a recording studio with the Beatles. In the 1970s, she wore pantsuits and lots of silky fabric like Kiana, and high-waisted bell-bottom jeans that hid her much-hated big feet. In the 1980s, she rocked the power suit in her new profession as a stockbroker, and by the 1990s was buying her suits at high-end boutiques and had added some very elegant accessories, like an expensive and impressive statement watch, a strand of perfectly matched pearls, handbags and shoes with some rather impressive designer names on them. After she retired, she filled her wardrobe with flowy, hand-painted silk dresses for summer and rich, opulent velvets and cashmeres for winter. My wardrobe is definitely informed by both my mother and my grandmother. I can rock a good trend when I want to, but mostly my wardrobe is pretty classic and timeless. I like a crisp white dress shirt with a pair of Levi's 501 jeans. I like a body-conscious sheath or wrap dress that emphasizes my hourglass figure. I love a good suit, and I love a string bikini. I like high heels and suede boots and simple, strappy leather sandals. I'll wear my camel-colored cashmere sweater with dark wash jeans and my leopard and snake print stack-heeled boots until the end of time, and then I'll buy another one of each and start all over again. But as easily as much as I love the clothes, I love procuring them. I'll take all the rolled eyes and conspicuous consumption epithets that may come my way. I love to go shopping. And this, too, I got from my grandmother and my mother. We did not have a lot of money when I was growing up. We weren't poor. We were middle class, but barely. And there just wasn't ever much wiggle room in the budget. So going shopping was kind of a big deal. And when it was the three of us, my mother, my grandmother, and me, it often became something of a special event. We didn't shop anywhere especially fabulous. I grew up in a small town in Northern California where there was a JCPenney and a handful of hippie chick dress shops and not much else. JCPenney was for socks and underwear, and while I made some memorable finds in those hippie chick shops, a pair of high-waisted, deep-pleated Annie Hall trousers come immediately to mind, in order to get in any really good shopping, we had to travel 45 minutes to get to the big department stores of downtown and suburban Sacramento. Some of the department stores were pretty high-end, Ransohoff's and I. Magnin. Some of them were stores you'd find in almost any mall, Weinstock's and Macy's and, a local favorite, the Liberty House at Sunrise Mall. The Liberty House department store at Sunrise Mall had a cool mid-mod vibe to it. The exterior was spare, concrete, minimalist. The interior had a rich, luxe feeling. The lights were dim. The walls were painted soft gray and velvety eggplant. All the fixtures were chrome, and the store was never overstocked, and the merchandise was never stuffy or frivolous. It was an atmosphere as much as anything else, a vibe. Just being there made me feel cool, and I knew that anything I bought there would be met by my friends with approving, if not envious, glances. But by far, my best memory of the Liberty House was the restaurant on the third floor. Restaurants and tea rooms were not uncommon in department stores in those days, and they aimed to seduce the weary shopper to put down her parcels and rest her tired feet with a hint of elegance. The restaurant at the Liberty House certainly seemed elegant to me when I was a kid. It was high-ceilinged with dark wood trim and all in that lush aubergine color. It felt hushed and calm, a refuge from the bright colors and shouting signage of the mall writ large. For me, there was only one thing to order when we sat down at a quiet table in what felt to me that very posh setting: French onion soup. My 12 and 13 and 14-year-old self thought it was the height of sophistication to spend a day shopping for beautiful clothes and then to sit down at a table laid with white linens, white china, and gleaming silverware and order French food. There are so many things we carry with us from childhood. A loving father teaches you how to throw a baseball. A beloved auntie teaches you how to dance at your wedding. A feisty cousin teaches you how to make a prank phone call. We call them traditions, but I think what they are at their core are things of deep pleasure and strong connection. That's why they last. And honestly, I didn't know how much I'd missed the deep pleasure and strong connection until that goofy, groovy, fun vintage store shopping trip a few weeks ago. When I got home, I tried all my purchases on again, took a few selfies, sent them to friends. When my best friend Bob replied that the tri-toned fake fur was fabulous beyond belief, I immediately and fondly recalled one of my best shopping memories ever. The day he talked me into buying the $1,200 dress. A Missoni knit that was so fine and so fragile, I actually got directions on how to fold and store it from the saleswoman when I bought it. After that, I totally needed a drink. We were in the Loop in Chicago, and we knew we didn't want a crowded and touristy place nor a homogeneous hotel bar. We wanted a neighborhood bar, but not a dive bar, a cocktail bar. Rounding a corner a few blocks off Michigan Ave, I spied an Aveda hair salon. "Let's ask in here," I said. "Hairdressers always know all the best places, and people who work in Aveda salons are cool." "Pops," the receptionist said. "Go to Pops. It's just three blocks down." "No, no," we said, thinking Pops was an old man beer joint. "We want cocktails." "Yeah," she said, "I get it. Go to Pops." 3 blocks later, we walked into the cutest black and white penny tile bentwood chair bistro and discovered, much to our delight, that it specialized in champagne cocktails. We grabbed a table by the window, piled all our shopping bags on the chairs beside us, and whiled the rest of the afternoon away in a fizzy haze. My favorite, a killer concoction of champagne, pear liqueur, and clove, called Drunk Girl, Home by Six. And I was. I haven't seen Bob for over 2 years. This is unusual for us. When we finished grad school some 25 years ago, and he moved to Michigan and I moved to North Dakota, we made a pact to see each other at least once a year. And until COVID hit, we kept that pact. When it's time to travel again, I'm sure getting together with Bob will be on the top of my list. But instead of him coming to my house or me going to his, I'm thinking perhaps we should meet in the middle. I'm thinking it's time for another Chicago trip. A shopping spree of massive post-pandemic proportions and an ocean of champagne cocktails to celebrate it. Meanwhile, I've got a good shopping friend much closer to home, and she knows all the good stores and all the best bars. And that's the best find of all.
That was a writer and a former English professor, Sean Ann Tangney.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 25th. In 1966, a Job Corps center opened in Bismarck at Fort Lincoln after the Army had declared the site as surplus. The first 22 men to arrive at the Lewis and Clark Job Corps Center had a quiet entrance into North Dakota, with little fanfare. However, this was perhaps a welcome relief, as much controversy had developed over the opening of the site in the past year, placing Bismarck squarely in the national news as tensions rose. It seemed that some residents opposed the establishment of this center because of rumors that the applicants were hopeless, below average in native intelligence, and with a criminal history. Some other concerns were characterized as racist commentary. Letters to the editor poured into local papers as people blasted that sentiment, but some asserted that the sentiments were indeed a reflection of attitudes in the state. However, Boyd Clemens, district manager of the North Dakota State Employment Service, set the public straight, noting that the men who applied had a desire to improve themselves and had healthy native intelligence that only needed encouragement. Governor Guy also came out in support of the center, noting the benefits that would come out of it as he encouraged residents to be accepting. Despite the heated debates, many residents did embrace the idea, and around 75 couples attended the orientation conferences at the center prior to the arrival of the young men. And by Thanksgiving of 1966, the public's attitude had improved. Rather than contention and concern, citizens were inviting the new community members into their homes for Thanksgiving. So many were invited that the Lewis and Clark Job Corps camp had to turn down Thanksgiving dinner invitations for its enrollees. There weren't enough corpsmen to go around. Not all of the corpsmen took residents up on the invitations, and those who decided to remain at the camp received a Thanksgiving meal and some special entertainment. In the end, the Lewis and Clark Job Corps Center was one of a number of camps suddenly shut down in early of 1968, possibly due to federal funding cuts, and those stationed in Bismarck were relocated or returned home to apply their new skills. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Sarah Walker. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
That's it for this Friday edition of Main Street. Thanks so much for listening, and enjoy the rest of your holiday weekend.